Tola to bring my father here and almost kill him into this story. Maggie added in her thoughts. She tried not to think about what Mo would say about the deal. However, Finolio already seemed to be searching for words in his mind. The right words. Words that would not betray and deceive him.
"Very well," he muttered abstractedly. "Let's get down to work one last time. But where am I going to find paper and ink, not to mention a pen and a helpful glass man? Paul Rosenquist is still in Umbra."
"I have paper," said Maggie, "and a pencil."
"That's very beautiful," said Finolio when she put her notebook in his lap. "Did your father bind it?"
Maggie nodded.
"There's some pages torn out."
"Yes, for a message I gave my mother and the letter I sent you. The one that Clown Dancer brought you."
"Oh. Oh, yes. Him."
For a moment, Finolio looked dreadfully tired.
"Books of blank pages," he murmured. "They seem to be playing more and more of a part in this story, don't you think?"
Then he asked Maggie to leave him alone with Farid so that the boy could tell him about Orpheus.
"To be honest," he whispered to Maggie, "I think he vastly overestimates the man's abilities. What has this fellow Orpheus done? Put my own words together in a different order, that's all. But I'll admit, I'm curious to meet him. Takes a fair amount of megalomania to give yourself a name like that. And megalomania is an interesting character trait."
Maggie did not share his opinion, but it was too late to go back on her promise. She would read again, for Farid this time. She went quietly back to her parents, laid her head on Mo's chest, and fell asleep hearing his heartbeat in her ear. Words had saved him. Why shouldn't they do the same for Dustfinger? Even if he had gone far, far away. Didn't the words of this world rule even the land of silence?
Chapter 73 The Blue Jay. Risa and Maggie were asleep when Mo woke, but he felt as if he couldn't breathe among all the stones and the dead a moment longer. The men guarding the entrance of the mine greeted him with a nod as he came climbing up to them. Pale morning light was seeping through the crevice that led to the outside world. The air smelled of rosemary, thyme, and the berries on Martola's poisonous trees. Mo's senses were constantly confused by the way the familiar mingled with the strange in Finolio's world, and by the fact that the strange features often struck him as more real than the others. The guards were not the only men Mo met at the entrance to the mine. Five more were leaning against the walls of the gallery, among them Snapper and the Black Prince himself.
"Ah, here comes the most wanted robber between Umbra and the sea," said Snapper, low-voiced, as Mo came toward them. They examined him like some new kind of animal, of which they had heard the strangest stories. And Mo felt more like an actor who had stepped on stage with the unpleasant feeling that he knew neither the play nor his part in it.
"I don't know how the rest of you feel,"
said Snapper, glancing around at the others, "but I always thought some writer had made up the Blue Jay, and that the only man who might lay claim to the feathered mask was our own Black Prince, even if he doesn't entirely match the description in the songs. So, when folks said the Blue Jay was a prisoner in the Castle of Night, I thought they just wanted to hang some poor fellow because he happened to have a scar on his arm. But then," he said, looking at Mo up and down as extensively as if assessing him by every line of every song he had ever heard about the Blue Jay, "then I saw you fight in the forest, and his sword blade flashes through them like a needle through the pages. Isn't that what one of the songs says? A good description indeed."
"Oh, yes, Snapper," thought Mo. "Suppose I were to tell you that the Blue Jay was really made up by a writer, just like you." How furtively they were all looking at him.
"We must get away from here," said the prince into the silence. "They're combing the forest all the way down to the sea. They've already found two of our hiding places and smoked them out. They haven't yet come upon the mine, but only because they don't expect us to be so close to their own back door." The bear grunted, as if amused by the stupidity of the men-at-arms. The gray muzzle and the furry black face, the clever little amber eyes. Mo had liked the bear even in the book, although he had imagined him slightly larger.
"Tonight, half of us will take the injured to the badger's earth," the Black Prince continued. "And the others will go to Ombra with me and Roxanne."
"And where does he go?"
Snapper was looking at Mo. Then they all looked at him. Mo felt as if their eyes were fingering his skin. Eyes full of hope. But what for? What had they heard about him? Were people already telling stories about what had happened at the Castle of Night? About the book full of blank pages and Fire Fox's death?
"He has to get away from here. What else do you think? A long way away."
The prince picked a dead leaf out of the bear's coat.
"The Adahead will be looking for him, even though he's spreading word everywhere that Mortola was responsible for the attack in the forest."
He nodded to a thin boy, at least a head shorter than Maggie, who was standing among the men.
"Tell us again what the crier announced in your village."
"This,"
the boy began in a hesitant voice.
"This is the Adderhead's promise. If the Blue Jay ever ventures to show his face in Argenta again, he will die the slowest death that the executioners of the Castle of Night have ever given anyone. And the man who brings him in will be rewarded with the Blue Jay's weight in silver."
"Best start starving yourself then, Blue Jay,"
mocked Snapper, but none of the others laughed.
"Did you really make him immortal?"
It was the boy who asked this question. Snapper laughed out loud.
"Listen to the lad. I expect you think the prince can fly, too, eh?"
But the boy took no notice of him. He was still looking at Mo.
"They say you yourself can't die," he said in a low voice. "They say you made yourself a book like that, too, a book of white pages with your death held captive in it."
Mo had to smile. Maggie had so often looked at him wide-eyed, just like that.
"Is it a true story, Mo? Come on, tell me."
They were all waiting for his answer, even the Black Prince. He saw it in their faces.
"Oh, I can die all right," he said. "Believe me, I have come very close. As for the Adderhead, however, yes, I have made him immortal, but not for long."
"What do you mean by that?"
The smile had long since frozen on Snapper's coarse-featured face. Mo was not looking at him but at the Black Prince when he answered.
"I mean that at present nothing can kill the Adderhead. No sword, no knife, no disease. The book I've bound for him protects him. But the same book will be his undoing, for he will have only a few weeks to enjoy it."
"Why is that?"
It was the boy again. Mo lowered his voice when he replied, just as he did when he was sharing a secret with Maggie.
"Oh, it's not particularly difficult to ensure that a book doesn't live long, you know. Particularly not for a bookbinder. And that's my trade, although so many people seem to think differently. Normally, it's not my job to kill a book. On the contrary, I'm usually called in to save the lives of books. But in this case, I'm afraid I had to do it. After all, I didn't want to be guilty of letting the Adderhead sit on his throne for all eternity, passing the time by hanging strolling players."
"Then you are a wizard?"
Snapper's voice was hoarse. "No, really, I'm not," replied Mo. "Let me say it once again. I'm a bookbinder." They were staring at him again, and this time Mo wasn't sure whether there might not be some fear mingled with the respect in their eyes.
"Off you all go now." The prince's voice broke the silence. "Go and make letters for the injured."
They obeyed, although every one of them cast a glance at Mo before they walked away. Only the boy, gave him a bashful smile, too. As for the Black Prince, he signaled to Mo to go with him. "A few weeks," he repeated when they were in the gallery where he and the bear slept, away from the others. "How many exactly?" "How many?" Even Mo couldn't tell for sure. If they didn't notice what he had done for the time being, it would all be quite quick. "Not very many," he replied. "And they won't be able to save the book?" "No." The prince smiled. It was the first smile Mo had seen on his dark face. "That's consoling news, Blue Jay. It saps one's courage to fight an immortal enemy. But you do know, don't you, that he'll only hunt you down all the more pitilessly when he realizes that you've tricked him." So he would indeed. That was why Mo hadn't told Maggie, had done what had to be done in secret while she was asleep. He hadn't wanted the Adderhead to see the fear in her face. "I don't intend to come back to this side of the forest," he told the prince. "Perhaps there'll be a good hiding place for us somewhere near Umbra." The prince smiled again. "I'm sure there will be," he said and looked at Mo as intently as if he meant to see straight into his heart. "Go on, try it," thought Mo. "Look into my heart and tell me what you find there, because I don't know myself anymore." He remembered reading about the Black Prince for the first time. What a fabulous character, he thought. But the man now standing before him was considerably more impressive than the image of him that the words had conjured up. Perhaps a little smaller, though. And a little sadder. "Your wife says you're not the man we take you for," said the prince. "Dustfinger said the same. He told me that you come from the country where he spent all those years when we thought he was dead. Is it very different from here?" Mo couldn't help smiling. "Oh, yes, I think so." "How? Are people happier there?"
Perhaps.
Perhaps?
The prince bent and picked up something lying on the blanket under which he'd slept. "I've forgotten what your wife calls you. Dustfinger had a strange name for you. Silvertongue. But Dustfinger is dead. And to everyone else, you will be the Blue Jay now. Even I find it difficult to call you anything else, after seeing you fight in the forest. So this belongs to you here in the future, unless you decide to go back after all. Back to the country where you came from, and where I suppose you have another name." Mo had never before seen the mask that the prince was holding out to him. The leather was dark and damaged here and there, but the feathers shone brightly, white, black, yellowish-brown, blue. The colors of a blue jay. "This mask has been celebrated in many songs," said the Black Prince. "I've allowed myself to wear it for a while. Several of us have done so, too. But now, it's yours." In silence, Mo turned the mask this way and that in his hands. For a strange moment, he felt an urge to put it on, as if he had done so many times before. Oh, yes, Finolio's words were powerful. But words they were. Nothing but words. Even if they had been written for him, any actor surely could choose the part he played. "No," he said, handing the mask back to the prince. "Snapper is right. The Blue Jay is a fantasy, an old man's invention. Fighting, I assure you, is not my trade." The prince looked at him thoughtfully, but he did not take the mask. "Keep it all the same," he said. "It's too dangerous for anyone to wear it now. And as for your trade, none of us here was born a robber." Mo said nothing to that. He just looked at his fingers. It had taken him a long time to wash off all the blood on them after the fight in the forest. He was still standing there holding the mask, alone in the dark gallery that smelled of the long-forgotten dead. When he heard Maggie's voice behind him, "Mo?" She looked at his face with concern. "Where have you been? Roxanne is setting out soon, and Risa wants to know if we're going with her. What do you say?" "Yes, what did he say?"
Where did he want to go?
Back to my workshop, he thought. Back to Eleanor's house.
Or did he? What did Maggie want? He had only to look at her to know the answer. Of course, she wanted to stay because of the boy, but he was not the only reason. Risa wanted to stay, too, in spite of the dungeon where they had put her, in spite of all the pain and darkness. What was it about Fenolio's world that filled the heart with longing? Didn't he feel it himself? Like sweet poison that worked on you only too quickly. What do you say, Mo?
Maggie took his hand.
How tall she had grown, and how pleadingly she looked at him. What do I say? He listened as though if he concentrated hard, he could hear the words whispering in the walls of the gallery, or in the weave of the blanket under which the Black Prince slept. But all he heard was his own voice. How would you like it if I said, "Show me the fairies, Maggie, and the water nymphs, and that illuminator in Umbra Castle. Let's find out how fine those brushes really are."
Dangerous words, but Maggie hugged him harder than she had since she was a little girl.
Chapter 74 Farid's Hope. When the men on guard raised the alarm for the second time just before sunset, the Black Prince ordered everyone to climb deep down into the mine, where the water was in the narrow passages, and you thought you could hear the earth breathing. But one man did not join them, Fenolio. When the prince gave the all clear, Maggie climbed up again with the others, her feet wet and her heart still full of fear. Fenolio came toward her and drew her aside. Luckily, Mo happened to be talking to Risa and didn't notice.
"Here you are, but I'm not guaranteeing anything," Fenolio whispered to her as he gave her back the notebook. "This is very likely another mistake in black and white just like the others, but I'm too tired to worry about it. Feed this damn story, feed it with new words, I'm not gonna listen. I'm gonna lie down and sleep. That was the last thing I will ever write in my life."
Feed it. Farid suggested that Maggie should read Fenolio's words in the place where he and Dustfinger had slept. Dustfinger's backpack was still lying beside his blanket, and the two martens had curled up to the right and left of it. Farid crouched down between them, and hugged the backpack to him as if Dustfinger's heart were beating inside. He looked expectantly at Maggie, but she remained silent. She looked at the words and said nothing. Fenolio's writing swam before her eyes as if, for the first time, it did not want her to read it.
"Maggie?"
Farid was still looking at her. There was such sadness in his eyes, such despair. For him, she thought. Just for him. And she kneeled down on the blanket where Dustfinger used to sleep. Even as she read the first few words, she sensed that Fenolio had done his work well yet again. She felt it like breath on her face. The letters on the page were alive. The story was alive. It wanted to take those words and grow. That was what it wanted. Had Fenolio felt the same when he wrote them? "One day, when death had taken much prey again," began Maggie, and it was almost as if she were reading a familiar book that she had only just laid aside. "Fenolio, the great poet, decided to write no more. He was tired of words and their seductive power. He had had enough of the way they cheated and scorned him, and kept silent when they should have spoken. So he called on another younger man, Orpheus by name, skilled in letters, even if he could not yet handle them with the mastery of Fenolio himself, and decided to instruct him in his art, as every master does at some time. For a while, Orpheus should play with words in his place, seduce and lie with them, create and destroy, banish and restore. While Fenolio waited for his weariness to pass, for his pleasure in words to reawaken,
and then he would send Orpheus back to the world from which he had summoned him, to keep his story alive with new words never used before. Meggie's voice died away. It echoed underground as if it had a shadow. And just as silence was spreading around them, they heard footsteps. Footsteps on the damp stone. Chapter 75. Alone Again. Orpheus disappeared right in front of Eleanor's eyes. She was standing only a few steps from him, holding the bottle of wine he had demanded, when he simply vanished into thin air. Into less than thin air. Into nothing. As if he had never been there at all. As if she had only dreamed him. The bottle slipped from her hand, fell on the wooden floorboards of the library, and broke among the books that Orpheus had left open there. The dog began to howl so horribly that Darius came racing out of the kitchen. The wardrobe man didn't bar his way. He was simply staring at the place where Orpheus had been standing a moment ago. His voice trembling, he had been reading from a sheet of paper lying in one of Eleanor's glass display cases right in front of him and clutching Inkheart to his breast, as if he could force the book to accept him at last in that way. Eleanor had stopped, as if turned to stone, when she realized what he was trying to do for the hundredth, even the thousandth time.
"Perhaps they'll come back out of the book to replace him," she thought, "or at least one of them, Maggie, Risa, Mortimer."
Each of the three names tasted so bitter on her tongue, as bitter as all that is lost. But now Orpheus had gone, and none of these three had come back. If only that damn dog refused to stop howling.
"He's done it," whispered Eleanor.
"Darius, he's done it. He's over there. They're all over there. All except us."
For a moment, she felt infinitely sorry for herself. Here she was, Eleanor Loredan, among all her books, and they wouldn't let her in. Not one of them would let her in. Closed doors enticing her, filling her heart with longing, and then letting her go no farther than the doorway. Accursed, blasted, heartless things, full of empty promises, full of false lures, always making you hungry, never satisfying you, never.
"But you once saw it quite differently, Eleanor,"
she reminded herself, wiping tears from her eyes. So what? Wasn't she old enough to change her mind, to bury an old love that had betrayed her miserably? They had not let her in. All the others were between their pages now, but she wasn't. Poor Eleanor. Poor lonely Eleanor. She sobbed so loudly that she had to put her hand over her mouth. Darius cast her a sympathetic glance and hesitantly came to her side. Well, at least he was still with her. That was one good thing. And of course he could read her thoughts in her face, as always. But he couldn't help her either.
"I want to be with them,"
she thought despairingly.
"They're my family, Risa and Maggie and Mortimer. I want to see the Wayless Wood and feel a fairy settle on my hand again. I want to meet the Black Prince, even if it means smelling his bear. I want to hear Dustfinger talking to fire, even if I can't stand the man. I want...
"Oh, Darius," sobbed Eleanor. "Why didn't the wretched fellow take me, too?"
But Darius just looked at her with his wise, owl-like eyes.
"Hey! Where did he go? That bastard still owed me money!"
Sugar went to the place where Orpheus had disappeared and looked all around him, as if Orpheus might be stuck among the bookshelves somewhere.
"Damn it! What does he think he's doing, just vanishing like that?"
He bent down and picked up a sheet of paper. The sheet of paper that Orpheus had been reading from. Had he taken the book with him and left behind the words that had opened the door for him? If so, then all was not lost after all. With determination, Eleanor snatched the sheet of paper from Sugar's hand.
"Give me that!"
she demanded, clutching it to her breast just as Orpheus had clutched the book. The wardrobe man's face darkened. Two very different things seemed to be struggling with each other on his face. Anger at Eleanor's boldness, and fear of the written words that she was pressing to her breast so passionately. For a moment, Eleanor wasn't sure which would get the upper hand. Darius came up behind her as if he seriously intended to defend her if necessary, but luckily Sugar's face cleared again, and he began to laugh.
"Well, look at that," he mocked her. "What do you want that scrap of paper for? Do you want to disappear into thin air, too, like Orpheus and the Magpie and your two friends? Huh? Feel free! But first I want the wages Orpheus and the old woman still owe me!"
And he looked around Eleanor's library as if he might see something in it that would do instead of payment.
"Your wages, yes, of course, I understand," said Eleanor, quickly leading him to the door. "I still have some money hidden in my room. Darius, you know where it is. Give it to him, all that's left, just so long as he goes away."
Darius did not look very enthusiastic, but Sugar gave such a broad smile that you could see every one of his bad teeth.
"Well, that sounds like sense at last,"
he grunted and stomped after Darius, who, resigned to this development, led him to Eleanor's room. But Eleanor stayed behind in the library. How quiet it suddenly was there. Orpheus had indeed sent all the characters he had read out of their books back into them again. Only his dog was still there, tail drooping as it sniffed at the spot where its master had been standing only a few minutes before.
"So empty,"
Eleanor murmured.
"So empty."
She felt desolate, almost more so than on the day when the Magpie had taken Mortimer and Risa away. The book into which they had all disappeared was gone. What happened to a book that disappeared into its own story?
"Oh, forget the book, Eleanor,"
she thought as a tear ran down her nose.
"How are you ever going to find them again now?"
Orpheus's words. They swam before her eyes as she looked at the paper. Yes, they must have taken him over there. What else? Carefully, she opened the glass case on which the paper had been lying before Orpheus disappeared and took out the book inside it. A wonderfully illustrated edition of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale signed by the author himself, and put the sheet of paper in its place. Chapter 76 A New Poet. At first, Orpheus could hardly be seen in the shadows filling the gallery like black breath. He stepped hesitantly into the light of the oil lamp by whose light Maggie had been reading. She thought she saw him put something under his jacket, but she couldn't make out what it was. Perhaps a book.
"Orpheus!" Farid ran to him, still holding Dustfinger's backpack in his arms. So he was really here. Orpheus. Maggie had imagined him very differently, much more impressive. This was just a man who was rather too stout, still very young, in an ill-fitting suit, and he looked as out of place in the ink world as a polar bear or a whale. In addition, he seemed to have lost his tongue. He stood there in a daze, looking at Maggie, at the dark gallery down which she had come, and finally at Farid, who had obviously entirely forgotten that the man he now greeted with such a radiant smile had stolen from him and betrayed him to Basta at their last meeting. Orpheus didn't even seem to recognize Farid, but when he finally did, it brought back his voice.
"Dustfingers, boy! How did you get here?" he faltered.
And yes, Beggy had to admit that his voice was impressive, much more impressive than his face.
"Well, never mind that. This must be the Ink World,"
he went on, taking no notice of Farid.
"I knew I could do it! I knew I could!"
A self-satisfied smile spread over his face. Gwyn leaped up hissing as he almost trod on his tail, but Orpheus didn't even notice the marten.
"Fantastic!" he murmured as he ran the palm of his hand over the gallery walls. "I suppose this is one of the passages that lead to the princely tombs under the castle of Ombra?"
"No, it's not," said Meggie coldly. "Orpheus,
in league with Mortola, a magic tongue deceiver. How empty his round face looked. No wonder, she thought with great dislike as she rose from the place where Dustfinger had slept. He has no conscience, no sympathy, no heart. Why had she brought him here? As if there weren't enough of this sort in the Ink World. I did it for Farid, replied her heart. For Farid.
How are Eleanor and Darius? If you've done anything to them...
Maggie didn't finish her sentence. If he had, then what? Orpheus turned with as much surprise as if he hadn't seen her at all before.
Eleanor and Darius. Oh, are you that girl who apparently read herself here?
His eyes became watchful. Obviously, he remembered what he had done to her parents.
My father almost died because of you.
Maggie was angry with herself for the way her voice shook. Orpheus blushed childishly red, whether in annoyance or embarrassment, Maggie couldn't have said, but whichever it was, he quickly recovered.
Well, how can I help it if Mortola had a score to settle with him? He replied. And from what you say, I take it he's still alive, so there's nothing to get upset about, is there?
Shrugging, he turned his back to Maggie. Strange, he murmured, glancing at the rubble at the end of the gallery, the narrow ladders and the props supporting the roof.
Will someone explain exactly where I am? This looks almost like a mine, but I didn't read anything about a mine.
Never mind what you read. I'm the one who brought you here.
Maggie's voice was so sharp that Farid cast her a glance of alarm.
You?
Orpheus turned and examined her so condescendingly that the blood rushed to Maggie's face.
You obviously don't know who you're talking to, but why am I bothering with you anyway? I'm tired of looking at this unattractive mind. Where are the fairies, the men-at-arms, the strolling players?
He roughly pushed Maggie aside and went to the ladder, but Farid barred his way.
You stay where you are, cheese-face, he snapped. Do you want to know why you're here? Because of Dustfinger.
Oh, yes.
There was derision in Orpheus's laughter.
Haven't you found him yet? Well, perhaps he doesn't want to be found, or not by a persistent fellow like you.
He's dead,
Farid interrupted brusquely.
Dustfinger is dead, and the only reason why Maggie read you here is for you to write him back.
She did not read me here. How many more times do I have to tell you?
Orpheus made for the ladder again, but Farid simply took his hand without a word and led him over to the place where Dustfinger was. Roxanne had hung his cloak in front of the gallery where he was still lying, motionless, as if the earth had crushed him. She and Risa had placed burning candles around him, dancing fire instead of the flowers usually laid beside corpses.
Good heavens! Exclaimed Orpheus when he saw him lying there. Dead? He really is dead. But this is terrible.
Maggie was amazed to see that there were tears in his eyes. His fingers shook as he took his misted-up glasses off his nose and polished them on his jacket. Then hesitantly, he went up to Dustfinger, bent, and touched his hand.
Cold,
he whispered and retreated. His eyes blurred with tears, he looked at Farid.
Was it Basta? Come on, tell me. No, wait, how did it go? Was Basta even there?
Some of Capricorn's men. Yes, that was it.
They were going to kill the Martin, and Dustfinger tried to save him.
I wet my eyes out when I read that chapter. I threw the book against the wall. And now I get here at last, and... I only sent him back because I thought he'd be safe here now. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, Dad.
Orpheus sobbed, and then fell silent. He bent over Dustfinger's body again.
Wait a moment.
Stabbed. Stabbed, that's what it says in the book. So where's the wound? Stabbed for the Martin's sake. Yes, that's what I said.
He turned abruptly and stared at Gwyn, who was perched on Farid's shoulders, hissing at him.
He left the Martin behind. He left him and you both behind. How is it possible that—
Fareed said nothing as the Martin affectionately licked his ear. Maggie felt so sorry for him, but when she put out her hand, he drew back.
"What's that Martin doing here? Tell me, have you lost your tongue?"
There was a metallic edge to Orpheus's beautiful voice.
"He didn't die for Gwyn," whispered Fareed.
"No? Who did he die for, then?"
"For me."
This time, Fareed did not withdraw his hand when Maggie took it. But before he could tell Orpheus any more, they heard another voice behind them, abrupt and angry.
"Who's this? What is this stranger doing here?"
Orpheus spun around as if caught in some guilty act. There stood Roxanne, with Risa beside her. Orpheus stared at her in amazement.
"Roxanne," he whispered.
"The beautiful minstrel woman. May I introduce myself? My name is Orpheus. I was a friend of Dustfinger's. Yes, I think one could say that."
"Maggie," said Risa in a faltering voice, "how did he get here?"
Maggie instinctively hid the notebook containing Finolio's words behind her back.
"So how is Eleanor?" Risa asked Orpheus sharply. "And Darius, what have you done to them?"
"Nothing," replied Orpheus.
In his confusion, he obviously didn't notice that the woman who had been able to speak only with her fingers had a voice again.
"Far from it. I went to a lot of trouble to help them feel more relaxed about books. They keep them like butterflies pinned in a case, each in its own place, imprisoned in their cells. But books want to breathe and sing. They want to feel the air between their pages and a reader's fingers tenderly stroking them."
Roxanne took Dustfinger's cloak from the prop over which she had draped it.
"You don't look like a friend of Dustfinger's to me," she interrupted Orpheus. "But if you want to say goodbye to him, do it now, because I'm going to take him with me."
"Take him with you? What do you mean?"
Fareed barred her way.
"Orpheus is here to bring him back." "Get out of my sight!" Roxanne snapped at him. "The very first time I saw you coming to my farm, I knew you brought bad luck. You ought to be dead, not Dustfinger. That's how it is, and that's how it stays."
Fareed flinched as if Roxanne had struck him. He did not resist as she pushed him aside and stood there with his shoulders drooping as she bent over Dustfinger. Maggie couldn't think of a way to comfort him, but her mother kneeled down beside Roxanne.
"Listen," she said quietly. "Dustfinger brought Fareed back from the dead by making the words of a story come true. Words, Roxanne. In this world they make strange things happen, and Orpheus knows a lot about words."
"Oh, yes, I do."
Orpheus quickly went to Roxanne's side.
"I made him a door of words so that he could come back to you. Did he never tell you?"
Roxanne looked at him disbelievingly, but the magic of his voice worked on her, too.
"Yes, believe me, I did it," Orpheus went on, "and I'll write something to bring him back from the dead. I'll find words as precious and intoxicating as the scent of a lily, words to beguile death and open the cold fingers he has closed around Dustfinger's warm heart."
A delighted smile lit up his face, as if he were already relishing his great achievements to come. But Roxanne just shook her head, as if to free herself from the magic of his voice, and blew out the candle standing around Dustfinger.
"No, I understand," she said, covering Dustfinger with his cloak. "You're an enchanter. I only went to an enchanter once, after our younger daughter died. People who go to enchanters are desperate, and they know it. They live on false hopes like ravens preying on carrion. His promises sounded just as wonderful as yours. He promised me what I most desperately wanted. They all do. They promise to bring back what's lost forever. A child, a friend, or a husband."
She drew the cloak over Dustfinger's still face.
"I'll never believe such promises again. They only make the pain worse. I'll take him back to Umbra with me, and find a place where no one will disturb him. Not the other head, not the wolves, not even the fairies.
and he will still look as if he were only sleeping long after my hair is white. For I know from Nettle how you go about preserving the body even when the soul is long gone.
You'll tell me where that is, won't you?
Farid's voice trembled, as if he knew Roxanne's answer already.
You'll tell me where you're taking him?
No, said Roxanne. You, least of all.
Chapter 77. Where now? Farid watched as they laid the injured on litters under cover of night. The injured and the dead. Six robbers were standing among the trees, listening for any sound that might mean danger. Only the tops of the silver towers were to be seen in the distance, bright in the starlight. Yet it seemed to them all that the Adder Head could see them. Could he sense it up in his castle when they stole soft-footed over Mount Adder? Who could tell what the Adder might be able to do now, now that he was immortal and invincible as death itself? But the night was still as Dustfinger, who was to be taken back to Umbra on a cart drawn by the Black Prince's bear. Meggie was going there, too, for the time being, to the other side of the forest, with Silvertongue and her mother. The Black Prince had told them of a village too poor and remote from any road to interest princes. He would hide them there, or on one of the nearby farms. Should he go with them? Farid saw Meggie looking at him. She was standing with her mother and the other women. Silvertongue was with the robbers, and hanging from his belt was the sword with which he had apparently killed Basta. And not just Basta. Almost a dozen men had died at his hands, so several of the robbers had told Farid, their voices lowered in respect. Amazing. Back in the hills around Capricorn's village, Silvertongue couldn't have killed a blackbird when they were in hiding together, let alone a human being. On the other hand, how had he himself learned to kill? The answer was not hard to find. Fear and rage. And there was enough of those in this story. Roxanne was with the robbers, too. She turned her back on Farid when she noticed him looking at her. She treated him like air, as if he had never returned to the land of the living, as if he were only a ghost, an ill-intentioned ghost who had devoured her husband's heart.
"What was it like being dead, Farid?"
Meggie had asked him. But he couldn't remember. Or perhaps he didn't want to remember. Orpheus was standing barely 2 paces away from him, shivering in the thin shirt he wore. The prince had told him he must change his light-colored suit for a dark cloak and woolen trousers. But in spite of all the clothes, he still looked like a cuckoo among sparrows. Fenolio was watching Orpheus like an old tomcat keeping a wary eye on a young one who has invaded his territory.
"He looks a fool."
Fenolio had whispered this comment to Meggie just loud enough for everyone to hear it.
"Look at him. A callow youth. He knows nothing about life. How is he going to be able to write? It might well be best to send him straight back, but never mind. There's no saving this wretched story now, anyway."
He was probably right. But why hadn't he at least tried to write Dustfinger back? Didn't he care anything for the characters he had created? Was he just moving them like pawns in a game of chess, enjoying their pain? Farid clenched his fists in helpless anger.
"I would have tried," he thought, 100 times, 1,000 times, for the rest of my life."
But he couldn't even read those strange little signs. The few that Dustfinger had taught him would never be enough to bring him back from where he was now. Even if he wrote his name in letters of fire on the walls of the Castle of Night, Dustfinger's face would remain as terribly still as when he last saw it. No. Only Orpheus could try it. But he hadn't written a single word since Maggie read him here. He just stood there, or paced, up and down, while the robbers watched him suspiciously. The glances Silvertongue cast him were not very friendly either. He had turned pale when he saw Orpheus again. For a moment, Farid had thought he would seize Cheeseface and beat him to a pulp, but Meggie had taken his hand and drawn him away. Whatever the two of them had said to each other, she wasn't telling Fareed. She had known that her father would not approve if she read Orpheus here, but she had done it all the same. For him. Was Orpheus interested in any of that? Oh, no. He was still acting as if his own voice, not Maggie's, had brought him here. Stuck-up, thrice-accursed son of a bitch.
Fareed, have you made up your mind?
Fareed came out of his gloomy thoughts. Maggie was standing in front of him.
You will come with us, won't you?
Risa says you can stay with us as long as you like, and Mo doesn't mind either. Silver Tongue was still standing with the robbers, talking to the Black Prince. Fareed saw Orpheus watching the two of them. Then he began pacing up and down once more, rubbed his forehead, smoothed back his hair, muttered as if talking to himself.
Like a lunatic, thought Fareed. I've pinned my hopes on a lunatic.
Wait here.
He turned away from Maggie and went over to Orpheus.
I'm going with Maggie, he said brusquely. You can go wherever you like.
Cheeseface straightened his glasses.
What are you talking about? Of course I'm coming with you. After all, I want to see everything. The Wayless Wood, the Laughing Prince's castle.
He looked up at the hill.
And of course I'd have liked to see the castle of night, too, but after what's happened here, I suppose it isn't a good time. Well, this is only my first day here. Have you seen the Adderhead yourself? Is he very terrifying? I'd like to see those silver scales on the columns.
You're not here to go sightseeing.
Fareed's voice was choked with anger.
What on earth was Cheeseface thinking of? How could he stand there looking around him as if he were on a pleasure trip while Dustfinger would soon be lying in some dark crypt or wherever Roxanne planned to take him?
Oh, no?
Orpheus's round face darkened.
Is that any way to talk to me? I'll do as I like. Do you think I've finally arrived where I always wanted to be just to have a snotty boy who has no business here anyway to order me around? You think words can simply be plucked from the empty air? This is all about death, you stupid boy. It could take months for me to get the right idea. Who knows? You don't call up ideas just like that, not even with fire. And we need a brilliant, a divine idea, which means...
Orpheus inspected his fingernails.
That I shall need a servant. Or do you want me to waste my time washing my own clothes and finding myself something to eat? The dog. The accursed dog. Very well. I'll be your servant, too.
Fareed brought the words out with difficulty. If you will bring him back.
Excellent, Orpheus smiled. Then, for a start, get me some food. It looks as if we're going to be embarking on a long and uncomfortable march.
Fareed gritted his teeth, but of course he obeyed. He would have scraped the silver from the towers of the Castle of Night to get Dustfinger breathing again.
Fareed, what is it? Are you coming with us?
Maggie stepped into his path as he ran past her, with bread and dried meat for Cheeseface in his pockets.
Yes, yes, we're coming with you.
He flung his arms around her neck, but only once he saw that Silver Tongue's back was turned to him. You never knew with fathers.
I'll save him, Maggie,
he whispered in her ear.
I'll bring Dustfinger back. This story will have a happy ending. I swear.
This is Brendan Fraser. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Inkspell by Cornelia Funke. This program was produced by Robert Kessler, directed by Scott Cresswell, executive producer Orly Moskowitz, original text copyright 2005 by Dressler Publishing, English translation 2005 by Antia Bell, production copyright 2005 Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.